Save big money when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior wood stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture. It repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Our knowledgeable team is ready to help bring your dreams to life, 1 gallon at a time. Stop by your local Menards today.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
All right, comments are open. Nolan Wells' independent autopsy came back undetermined. No fractures, no deep tissue injuries, no lacerations. But the pathologist couldn't rule out foul play either because Mississippi retained the neck structures from the first autopsy, which, by the way, is 1,000% normal and protocol basically for an autopsy of how these sort of things function. It's not an outlier as some may try to present it to be. This is how it works. You can't peel an orange two times. You get one first chance at it, and then a second autopsy is kind of like that. We're going to go through where things are at from the middle and still saying, we don't know, because the autopsy is just one piece of this puzzle. The phone's going to tell us a lot. There's other things that are going to tell us a lot, but this is definitely a piece that's in. Joining myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI Special Agent, Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, is defense attorney and former prosecutor Eric Faddis to help us break down what's going on. Two autopsies deep, and nobody can say how this kid died. The first autopsy results, we do not have the results from as of yet, or the toxicology as of yet, because that does still take some time. So what exactly, once we do convene a grand jury here, what does a grand jury do with we don't know, now that we have one of the autopsies in? The independent pathologist says Mississippi kept the neck structure, so he can't rule out strangulation. They're going to look at that. Does undetermined actually help this family get answers, or does it just keep this door open basically forever, Eric?
You know, I lean more towards it keeping the door open indefinitely at this point. You know, the autopsy does not make any affirmative conclusions that would be overly helpful to a grand jury. In another sense, it doesn't rule things out. So there are options to consider in terms mm-hmm. of trying to ascertain what happened here. But does it really move the needle? Is it going to be the difference between a grand jury indictment and what's called a no true bill? It's not going to be that difference.
What's a no true bill?
That's where a grand jury reviews the evidence and determines that there is not probable cause to bring any criminal charge.
What do you think it would take to get to there, vice the other directions? And I'm going to layer multiple questions. So take whatever you want, Eric, on this one. You know, in that area, as well as what do you think the family and the public could want to see between these two autopsy results to say, and for the public to say, yeah, there's nothing here other than a tragic
death. Something there. Right, what would, I guess, pull that needle in whatever direction other. It goes?
Something that is evidence of something more than just what could be interpreted as an accidental drowning. If there's evidence of some sort of injury, some sort of damage to the body, and I think we'll talk a little bit more about the mm-hmm. findings in detail, but that would be helpful. Also, some sort of evidence of criminal activity, meaning like a witness saw something, heard something, there was an altercation, there was an argument, something like that, that they can actually tie in a compelling way to this incident. Right now, we just don't have that stuff.
How important is it to a grand jury? Because that is step one for folks who are playing along at home. A grand jury, you're not convicting someone. It's the next step to going down a criminal path, if there is one to go down, or determining, no, there's nothing criminal here. That's the true bill or not true bill determination. But to get there, when they're looking at all the evidence here in an autopsy being one of many pieces of evidence that a grand jury will look at. They're not convening one until the investigation essentially has come to a bit of a close. So that'd be when we have the toxicology and when they have the first autopsy results and when they have the phone data in. When they have all that, they will convene the grand jury and put it out there. So there'll be a lot in front of them. But one of those things will be the autopsy. So when we get to a grand jury and they're looking at all the evidence, how much weight does a grand jury put on an autopsy, and how readily smart are they, for lack of a better term, how good are they at deciphering typically the weight of the autopsy versus digital evidence, digital footprints, and information that's out there? How do grand juries deal with autopsies today?
Sure. So an autopsy can be pivotal. You know, it can provide the grand jury with evidence. One of the central functions of an autopsy is to determine the cause of death and manner of death. Cause of death is usually has sort of a medical basis. Was a person shot? Did their heart stop? What was the cause medically? Manner of death is like, is this a homicide, meaning an unlawful killing? Was it an accident? Was it undetermined? So those things can be really helpful. But when the conclusion in the autopsy is undetermined, it really doesn't leave the jury with a lot to work off of on that front. And then in terms of evaluating the strength of that evidence as compared to other evidence like witness statements, digital forensics, things like that, we hope that the prosecutors would present all of that and try to explain it in some cogent fashion. But grand jury proceedings are somewhat secret. It's really the prosecutor or the grand jury. We don't know exactly what could be going on if that happens. So it's hard to say how the jury might receive evidence because we don't know exactly how it'll be presented and characterized.
Eric, with when it comes to the autopsy, they're going to be obviously getting the autopsy results from the government. Are they also going to get autopsy results from the private autopsy, or is it just going to be the government side?
That's a darn good question, Robin, because that's kind of an issue that a lot of people have with grand jury proceedings is that, one, it's so secret, and two, it's one-sided. It's only the prosecutor, and they kind of get to decide what they want to give this grand jury and have them evaluate. So, you know, at least in theory, a prosecutor could decide, hey, I like this first autopsy. I don't like the second one so much, or vice versa, and present only one of the autopsies, which I think would be a disservice to the grand jury and to the sense of justice. But the fact that they even have that option is concerning to some.
Yeah. And then, so what's the prosecutor trying to, I mean, what's their intent in doing the grand jury? Are they trying to move to trial? Are they trying, you know, is there a confirmation bias that prosecutors are trying to do or not trying to do? Or, I mean, show us how the sausage is made a little bit about what they're trying to accomplish during the grand jury.
Also an important question because there can be different objectives that prosecutors have in bringing a grand jury. One could be that they think they have probable cause and they want it to get rubber stamped by a grand jury to move forward with a criminal charge. Another could be that they are unclear as to whether they have probable cause and they need to get sort of a second set of eyes on this. A third could be that they don't want to make the decision themselves because there could be a public uproar. So let me punt this decision to these, unwitting grand jury members of the public and it can be on their heads with whatever happens.
Obviously, every case is different that goes in front of a grand jury. But statistically speaking, because grand juries are so secretive, most people don't really fully understand them. I mean, I only understand them from what I've learned over the last however many years talking with y'all. Is there a rate at which, like, what percentage of cases that go to a grand jury, which are far more than we're aware of, actually end up facing criminal prosecution versus a grand jury saying a no true bill, meaning there's nothing to prosecute here?
Totally. On that question, you know, there's this old adage in the law that you can indict a ham sandwich, meaning you can. Meaning it's so easy. It's so easy.
It's good
to obtain an indictment. One, the standard is super low. It's probable cause. Are there reasonable grounds to believe a crime was committed and that someone else committed it? And two, the prosecutor is steering the entire ship. They get to decide exactly what the grand jury sees. And so the likelihood of an indictment once a case is presented to the grand jury is very high. And that's why there's been a lot of sort of surprise in terms of some of these DOJ efforts to get an indictment and then failing to do so. That's rather uncommon. So charges are common once it's presented to the grand jury.
Does this have to go to a grand jury? Is that just like, without a doubt, no matter what, because we don't know exactly what happened to him, it's going to land in a grand jury's lap? Regardless, just to basically cross the T's and dot the I's?
It depends on the state, but nearly all states allow the prosecution to proceed by complaint and information instead. So the prosecutor typically could make the determination themselves, could say, hey, I think we got probable cause here. I'm going to file these charges. I'm going to move forward in that fashion without the grand jury even being involved. But usually when it's a closer call, and also when there is sort of a national fervor about the case, that they'll punt it to the grand jury and have them make the decision so that the prosecutors can kind of say, hey, public, if you don't like the decision, well, it wasn't us. It was the grand jury. Sorry.
Robin's got stats. I can tell.
You're getting to read my tells. Yeah. Once a case reaches a grand jury with a prosecutor asking for charges, the odds of it moving the next phase indictment are extremely high, well over 99%.
Oh, well, there
so my,
you go.
So my question then is, who? I mean, so looking for an indictment, and if you've conducted at least 60 interviews from the last time we saw, and we've seen the videos of the, well, I mean, I'll just describe it as mayhem. You have tons of boats, tons of people, tons of activity, tons of people that were interacting, mismatching all over the place. So if you're looking for an indictment, who do you go after? I mean, do you start with a fishing net? I mean, how's that work?
Does it have to be about a specific person?
Right, that's my question. Right?
Yeah, or can it be something suspicious happened here? We still don't know who, but can a grand jury basically initiate the deeper investigation to try and find the answer to the who, or do they have to have a who in their sights before they issue a true bill?
You know, in the substantial majority of cases, law enforcement has what's called the target in a grand jury investigation. Right. That's the person they believe charges may be levied against. And it's for the grand jury to decide whether to charge the target and to charge other folks, too. So almost always they already have somebody in mind. However, grand jury investigations are just that proceedings are investigative in nature, in the sense that the grand jury can issue subpoenas themselves. The grand jury could say, hey, you know what? We want to hear from this dude in the red shirt in this video. We think he might have information. Let's subpoena him to come tell us what he knows. They can do the same thing with documents, with forensic digital stuff. And so it can really be an investigative tool to get to the truth, but usually you have at least some target in mind when you're bringing it from the outset.
And probably, and correct me if I'm wrong on this too, because the way my mind works when doing investigations always is I'm looking for the wobbles. And so would they be then the prosecutor basically saying, hey, you know, if I'm looking at an equal field, say I have a couple hundred people and I brought it to a grand jury, and like you said, they're going to kind of direct in a certain area. They're basically looking for at least one or a couple of people that kind of, not that they thought they necessarily did anything wrong, but that's where they want to be able to dive deeper because they saw a little bit of a wobble of behavior. Maybe they overheard a fight or someone recorded that, you know, someone had some issues with someone or just some sort of wobble. Is that enough for allow the prosecutor to say, all right, we're going to focus in this area, even if that through their investigation, it might not be over here, it goes over here?
Totally. I mean, they can have multiple potential targets in mind. You see this in like gang cases where they don't know who the shooter is, but there's, you know, there's this gang that was present. We know that there were five dudes there. Let's look more into these five folks and then narrow from there as we go. And a similar approach could be taken if this case was presented to a grand jury.
And then 30 years later, you finally are going to go to trial for the person who shot Tupac. Only 30 years to get there. Longer than he actually lived. 300 people estimated on Horn Island that day. 60 witnesses have reportedly been interviewed. Three friends cooperating, giving the statements. Those are the boys from the boat. Not one person out of hundreds has described seeing anything criminal happen to Nolan Wells. What does that tell you? If you're a defense attorney, like if you're in, let's just say this, if you're in the shoes of the parents here who are going through hell, their son just died. The world is saying, this is what happened. And the another half is saying nothing happened. And you're stuck in the middle because something's got to make sense here. As something happened to your son, you don't know what it is. But if you're trying to be objective here on the outside, and your interest is in the well-being of that family and 300 people, if something happened, you would think at this point, we're almost a month into this case, that somebody would have said something. It would be somewhere. You're not going to get that many people all shutting up simultaneously. It just doesn't happen that way. What does that tell you right now, you know, as an attorney and just as a person who's been around the law, been around cases, and you don't have any leakage right now of anybody remotely, as far as we can tell, that's coming out with anything that seems nefarious here?
You know, you start to think about what the potential explanations for this young man could be. And one of them, I suppose, is that this was completely an accidental drowning, and that I guess near this island or the water around it, where there were at least 100 people, according to videos, probably more than that. Zero people just saw this person go into the water for what reason, and then accidentally died, but that didn't make any sound, didn't call for help. No one else saw that. I mean, that's one explanation, but how plausible is that? How reasonable is that? Does that comport with like what we understand about human nature and how groups react and these big events, things like that? It kind of doesn't. And well, so what it tells me is that someone must have seen something, heard something. I just can't fathom that this person, you know, would be in a group of folks talking, carrying on, and then jump in the water and drown without anybody seeing it.
If you're in a group and suddenly you get swept away, of course. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I don't see how people would not be able to talk about that or see that. You know, or even if there was a fight somewhere, I would think you'd have somebody, oh yeah, there was a altercation over there, unless it was very off to the side and nobody's noticing it, or he went into the water by himself in some corner of the island for a few moments and then got caught in a riptide. I mean, the reality is, I mean, yes, it does. I think that's really troubling about this case, is it does seem to contradict how we think about trauma, how we think about human behavior and fighting and all that in a land setting, in one that doesn't have riptides around you and boats and boat motors and lots of drunk people. A lot of drownings are exactly this. We don't know how they got out there or where they went away or when they went away because it is so silent. It's not typically flailing and raising your hands and, though we lost him. That's not how a lot of drownings go in reality. And I mean, if nobody is saying something because they didn't see anything, I mean, does that point more to that than anything else?
It certainly is suggestive of that. And I suppose that in theory, a person could go take a dip away from everybody else, not tell anybody. The other folks don't notice that he's doing that. He goes in and gets caught by a riptide, doesn't make any sounds or anything like that. That's possible. And, you know, at least at this juncture, if something did happen, like you said, I would expect at least one person would say something.
You think?
It's not some huge, you know, 200-person conspiracy cover-up thing. That's not plausible either.
So
yeah, exactly.
I did some research. Key patterns from data and case reviews, and this actually one from Medical Examiner in Palm Beach County found that roughly, believe it or not, 70% of drowning deaths were unwitnessed when in large groups like this. 70%. So it's not unheard of, because when, you know, to Eric, what Eric was saying, when you have large groups of people and you have community pockets engaging with each other, the focus, remember, as a human being, we pick up things in peripherals, but we can only focus on one thing at a time. And so if you're in a small cluster groups or your boat cluster groups, you're not going to necessarily pick up, unless someone is over the top yelling, screaming, yelling, which if they're drowning, maybe not. I mean, again, it's hard to say conjecture, but the research says roughly 70%, at least up to that amount, are drownings with other people around, unbeknownst, especially if you have a strong riptide and stuff. So It's within plausibility. As much as I was with you on this, as much as it seems implausible, because when you have two implausible situations, where do you go?
Yeah.
But it's not totally implausible.
Yeah. There's just so many questions.
Sad.
That's this part of the segment. Encourage your thoughts and comments in the comment section, Substack and YouTube. The links are there in the description. We're going to continue talking about this.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.